The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thanks for having me. I don't come here so often, but enough that it's many, many familiar faces, and it's nice to see you. This morning, we'll speak about grief, and I feel like it's important actually to, in a way, have your consent to listen, you know. And so there are times when that's really not what you need to hear about, yeah? And other times when it feels like, this actually is supportive for the heart. So IMC, as you know, offers money-back guarantee, and I will not be offended if you leave and if it's just not right. And of course, delighted to have you if it feels like, okay, yeah, that's right. So, of course, is a kind of, it feels like a heavy, heavy talk, and it's important to remember that the insight into dukkha is not dukkha, yeah? The insight into suffering is not suffering. And to the extent that we can understand and open the heart to the realities of being human, the Buddha says this is onward leading. Yeah. So Leonard Cohen said, I cried for you this morning and I'll cry for you again, but I'm not in charge of sorrow, so please don't ask me when. A bunch of years ago, I was at a lecture in Los Angeles with Joseph Goldstein, and he did he let us sit and gave a talk, and then he opened the evening for questions, and a friend of mine stood up. It was several hundred people. A friend of mine stood up and said, Joseph, 10 years ago I heard you talk, and I asked you to summarize the practice in one sentence. And what you said then was, anything can happen anytime. And then my friend went on to say, and here we are, it's 10 years later, you've practiced 10 more years, you're 10 more years older, you've matured in many ways over that decade. What's your answer now? And Joseph said, to sum up the Dharma, said, the mind that's not clinging to anything. And this path is often construed as a path of letting go, of non-clinging. But what does that actually look like? What does it actually look like to let go? You know? What is bound up in that process? And what I would suggest is what's involved in that process is often something like grieving. Yeah. You know, when we love in a world that changes, grief becomes a feature of being human, right? And the truth is, we don't even really have a choice but to love. You know? It's like, yeah, it's what mammals do. Yeah, it's what we as mammals do. We love. Yeah. And so etched into our own biology is this reality of grieving. And, you know, the truth is there are really those of us who have grieved and those who will. This is a universal experience of being human. Now, sometimes grief is a kind of, there's an acute loss, the loss of a person, the loss of love, the loss of a relationship, the loss of an idea, the loss of an illusion. And we know exactly what we're grieving. We know what's been lost. We know what we want to the heart. And then there are other times when the loss is very vague and amorphous, and we don't even know exactly what we're grieving, but it feels like something is missing. Steve Armstrong said, you know, the clenched fist of grasping when we kind of harden the fist into that the clenched form. Over time, the kind of pain of that, we acclimatize to that. The hand becomes numb. And then to be asked actually to begin to release the clenched fist, the movement from this to this actually may be even more painful than the clench itself, yeah? And the name that we give that movement from this to that is called grief. For some years in my practice, especially when I would do metta practice, when I would do loving kindness practice, I would just sit there and the tears would just come. And I didn't know what they were or where they came from or what was being grieved. And they didn't hurt exactly. There was a kind of a poignancy in them, but there was just this sense of like, whoa, feel like I'm grieving the suffering of my life, the suffering of the human condition, you know, the kind of sense of the loss of having lived in a certain way without knowing that greed, hatred, and delusion were propelling my life. And so much, I think much of the way we actually make progress along the path, the way that actually the goodness of the Dharma begins to accrue in our hearts comes out of this kind of quiet process of grieving. Now, this is a kind of individual phenomena, but importantly, this is also something we need to do at a collective level. We actually have to grieve at a kind of national level, because our own kind of sense of who we are, the national self-image, the national self-esteem has failed to actually grieve the harm that began with the founding of the nation and the perpetuation of harm in all kinds of violence and inequity. And so I feel like we as a country have this like very precarious sense of who we are, of national self-esteem. And it's made precarious by our failure to fully own the devastation of history and the continued suffering of that's disproportionately experienced by people in the country. And so there's a way in which actually, as a nation, there's work to be done, and that's happening. There's an African medicine man who said something like, "Our streets are filled with the ungrieved dead." Yeah. To love is to risk. And the more deeply we surrender, the more courage that takes, the more risk there is. This is Rilke. "It's possible I am pushing through solid rock in flint-like layers as the ore lies alone." "I'm such a long way in, I see no way through and no space. Everything is close to my face, and everything close to my face is stone. I don't have much knowledge yet in grief, so this massive darkness makes me small. You be the master, make yourself fierce, break in. Then your great transforming will happen to me, and my great grief cry will happen to you." You know, there are different ways of thinking about grieving in the Buddhist tradition, and one way is that it's actually a kind of, it's a function of clinging, yeah. And it's like, oh, we should have known, we should have more fully absorbed the truth of anicca, of impermanence, of unreliability. We should have more fully absorbed the truth of inconstancy into the heart. But my feeling is much more that grief is like... is not a corruption of insight, is more like a wound, actually, that heals very slowly. And to command a wound to heal more quickly is kind of merciless. Yeah. And so we want to be really careful in how we can get into this mode of applying Dharma teachings in this formulaic way that sometimes actually serve to short-circuit a process of healing that needs to unfold, the rhythms of grief that need to be honored. A friend of mine described grief as it's like living in a Rumi poem that doesn't end. That's pretty fucked up. Yeah. In general, the Buddha wanted to be free. You know, there's that refrain of free from grief, sorrow, and lamentation. And importantly, like as the story, the archetypal mythological story goes, the Buddha's mom died shortly after his birth, like the most primal form of grief. I think you know, some commentators have suggested that this is some of the kind of the spirit of Buddhist monasticism may be a reflection or a kind of response to the depth of that wound, yeah? And so, yeah, in some ways we would think like, okay, the Buddha's beyond grief, but then there are examples where like a couple close disciples, I think, Sariputra, Moggallana, have died, as the sutta goes, it's like the Buddha's in a hall with 500 monastics, and he says something like, you know, with these two dear disciples passed on, it is as if this hall were empty, as if the sun were blotted out, yeah? And then the sutta goes on at the end to say something like, but the Buddha did not suffer, you know? And I'm like, oh, why'd you have to add that, you know? Like, do we have to make, you know, our ideals that like that just so impermeable, you know? And no doubt people would have very different views than this. But what I would say is that I want my Buddha to grieve. Yeah. When we think about Dharma practice, we usually think about this kind of difficult, negative, afflictive emotions being reduced. And I think that's right. I think for a lot of, for anger and anxiety, fear, you know, like embarrassment, shame, self-judgment, all of that, like mindfulness really makes that hurt so much less, or changes the intensity with which all that arises, or it changes the duration that those kinds of difficult emotions are up. It shortens the trace of them. But with grief, I feel like it cuts even more deeply. It's like there's less static in the heart. The heart is undefended, and in a way that actually makes space for it to permeate more deeply. And so while I can easily imagine a kind of life without anger, without anxiety, I can't imagine, I don't even know what it would look like to live a life without grieving. You know, that seems like actually like a foundational capacity in our ethical life, in sila, to know how to grieve, to actually know how to do that. Feels like the wellspring of so much of our ethical goodness. So sometimes, like, in order not to grieve, we just try to control where the love flows, yeah? But we're not so successful with that, you know? This is psychologist Roy Baumeister. Seems fair to conclude that human beings are fundamentally and pervasively motivated by a need to belong. That is, by a strong desire to form and maintain enduring interpersonal attachments. If psychology has erred with regard to the need to belong, the error has been to underappreciate it. The desire for interpersonal attachment may well be one of the most far-reaching constructs available to understand human nature. This is Mary Oliver in Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Each year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires in the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. The mind quite naturally defaults to the assumption of permanence. It's like sort of how we construct our emotional life, our emotional stability. You know, it's just to a certain kind of assumption of permanence. And when that is disrupted, when grief cuts deeply, it's so stunning to the mind. It's so jarring. And when it's strong, it's really as if we have gone to sleep and slept well, and we wake up and the home around us has burned down. And it's like the mind is just grappling and moving in all these directions with how could this be so? How could it be so? Even after loss, there's this, the mind is a kind of, it feels like it's in a mode of bargaining, of kind of vacillating between a certain acceptance and confusion and disbelief. And at times our strategies work, and there's a sense of like, some relief from the relentlessness of it. And then those strategies stop working and the grief returns. And these kinds of like, yeah, the vicissitudes of equanimity, like I feel like the mind is trying to get bearable doses of our vulnerability, bearable doses of pain, you know, to like titrate it, to get the right amount, the as much as the heart can handle and not more. And sometimes we get too much, you know. And I don't want to make light of the ways that denial and all of this functions, like that has that's with a sort of a dismissed kind of that mind state we have a very dismissive attitude towards in Buddhist practice. Everything is about turning towards, is about the opposite of avoidance. And yet we actually really have to sometimes honor our capacity. Like, what dose can we take in right now? For a while, the job is just to survive. Yeah. Uh, Stephen Levine said, grief is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. Maybe you know that experience of just like the headlights only reach so far. Redemption is unimaginable. Yeah. And yet this is how we make the journey. Yeah. The light only reaches so far, but this is actually how we make the journey. Yeah. I helped teach a class for undergrads at UCLA in mindfulness stuff. And I was giving a talk, and I think it was a talk on love and, you know, mindfulness as it relates to, you know, interpersonal relationships and romantic commitments. And one of the kids, like, she raised her hand and asked, you know, she's maybe like 19 years old, and asked a question about heartbreak, you know, and like her heart was broken. And when she asked that, what came to mind was a piece of writing from Freud, like this old famous essay, Mourning and Melancholia, where he basically says, like, the way that we get over heartbreak is to reinvest the ego in someone else, something else, yeah? And so I said this and, you know, gave a little summary of the paper, and my co-teacher, Marv Belzer, like, jumps up and he's like, no! 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 And he says, I don't know so much about love, but I do know about the beauty of heartbreak. Yeah. And suggested, like, no, like, there's actually, like, let us not skip forward too quickly. Let us actually redeem the beauty, the poignancy of heartbreak. And so, for me, you know, the grief that I've experienced, the function of Dharma has been to not to insulate me against hurt, but to prevent my heart from being harmed. Yeah. And maybe you know those pains that hurt, and maybe hurt like hell. But that is different than the heart being harmed. Maybe this is the function of Dharma. And so the redemption I feel of grief, of grieving, is love. Yeah. And it's a love that's bigger than the person, object, idea, where it had been contained, yeah. There's a way in which you know, we come up against places in practice, in our lives, where it's like the ego is all out of moves, you know? Like, you know those times that happens in life, but maybe especially on retreat, yeah? Yeah, and it's like, we try like all our Dharma karate moves on some form of suffering, you know? And then at some point it's just like, I got nothing else, yeah? And in that gesture of like, I got nothing else, sometimes the heart breaks open to a kind of a groundlessness. And that groundlessness, like, is precious. And life is just like, it's just quivering with freshness, you know, just vitality, the sense of like the preciousness to be able to just live this moment. And we actually have to learn to swim amidst that groundlessness. It feels like, I don't know how you can live here. I don't know how you can have, you kind of like, you have to develop kind of like sea legs amidst that kind of free fall. And that kind of it actually takes practice. It takes practice to start to like let the body, mind soften amidst that kind of groundlessness. But this is a preparation for so much. It's a preparation for the kind of deeper phases of insight practice, where all of our reference points are gone. And we actually have to find a new way of sourcing our motivation to take the next step. We just don't know. And this kind of practicing in groundlessness is I imagine also indispensable for how we can die. And yeah, so much of, yeah, my practice, I feel like it's like subtly motivated by the enormity of mortality. And to the extent that we can become even a little bit freer of the fear of death, the mind opens so profoundly. Even a little reduction in that fear and the sense of like the vastness and openness of life becomes just so prominent. And so we actually learn to swim in that kind of groundlessness, preparing for our own deepest kind of letting go, of not needing to hold on to all of the ordinary reference points of who we are, of what we are. And this breeds a very deep kind of gratitude for whatever life we have. Like when we actually really take into the heart the that we own nothing. When we take that in, that's different than, it's not that we don't influence things, but we own nothing. And when we take that into the heart, whatever goodness enters our life feels like a gift from beyond. This is Catherine Schultz quote I like. And she is talking about, writing about the loss of her father and the kind of that phrase of loss, to lose one's keys, to lose one's father, when things go